This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Well, the topic today will be the evolution of the mind, with particular attention to the felt side, consciousness in a broad sense, and with a focus on non-human animals. There won't be anything on artificial systems. The theme, I think, is apt for the Howison lecture, even if there's not a lot of agreement between us. George Howison's main collection of essays is called The Limits of Evolution, and other essays illustrating the metaphysical theory of personal idealism. He opens the first essay saying that all-encompassing ideas about evolution, which were characteristic of his time, even when they look to explain the origins of the mind, are not a vindication of materialism, but of idealism. However, the main options that result he regards as still hostile to the ideas of freedom and the immortality of the individual soul that we should not give up, at least not likely, and so he looks to resist. Well, my own approach will be biological, and a lot of the talk will work through a series of experiments and other observations of non-human animals at great evolutionary distance from ourselves. Now, what do I mean by evolutionary distance? Well, the shape of evolutionary history, especially in animals, is the shape of a tree. All animals are related by common ancestry with deeper and shallower branchings. So time is going up the screen here, and animals alive now are along the top. This tree of life had been seen as a representational device or metaphor for a while, as a way of organizing our thinking about the similarities between groups. Then Darwin said in 1859, "I believe this simile largely speaks the truth. A tree is not a scale or a ladder, though those similes have been slow to lose currency." Now, the origin of life itself was probably a bit over 3.5 billion years or so ago. Animals have been around since something like 700 million years. The first fossil evidence we have of animal life is from a time now referred to as the Ediacaran. The first fossils from this time were found by a mining engineer and adventurer, Reg Sprigg, in Australia. This is a picture of Sprigg with his homemade deep diving chamber. As now reconstructed, this first period in the history of animals was a quiet time, a fauna of bath mat-like and frond-shaped organisms with the occasional meandering macaroon. Despite a good deal of density, there seems to have been very little interaction, hardly any evidence of predation, for example. Instead, a world of bath mats that pass in the night. But this was the time of the evolution of nervous systems. We know that from the dates of early branchings on the tree, where on each side there is a nervous system. Now, if it was so quiet, why did animals even need nervous systems? Well, as well as serving basic input-output functions, nervous systems may have functioned during this time just to pull the animal together, to make coherent action possible on the new scale of animal life. Then we reach the Cambrian, beginning around 540 million years ago or so. This was the beginning of what we might think of as the familiar regime of animal life, with vision, interaction, predation, bodies with claws and spines and eyes, bodies with tools for action, especially within bodies built on a plan featuring left-right symmetry. Now, the last common ancestor, or the most recent common ancestor of animals with that left-right symmetry, lived before this time in the Ediacaran, but this bilaterian platform took off. What was the common ancestor like? This will matter a couple of times later in this talk. It was definitely marine. It was small, maybe a bit like a flatworm. There are various reconstructions. Here is a more recent reconstruction. It may have had eye spots, perhaps a very simple brain. So the common ancestor of all bilaterally symmetrical animals lived in the Ediacaran, and from here, many different animal groups evolved, including three groups with conspicuous behavioral complexity in some species. And those three groups are arthropods, which included the first animal predators that we know of, arthropods, the group that now includes insects, spiders, and crustaceans. Cephalopods, a group of mollusks, not including octopuses, but back then, giant zeppelin-like shellfish that became active after the Cambrian. Vertebrates also evolved back then. They were insignificant slivers at first, but then fish evolved jaws, the zeppelins were downed, and some vertebrates eventually made a transition to land. Now, I mentioned sort of three groups of animals with this conspicuous behavioral complexity that we'll be talking about: arthropods, cephalopods, and vertebrates like ourselves. As Michael Trestman puts it, these are the animals with what can be called complex active bodies. And these will be our focus when we look at questions about subjectivity, consciousness, felt experience, the felt side of the mind. For this first part, I'll just work within a familiar and conventional way of setting things up, where we have a distinction between the cognitive side of the mind and an experiential side, where it's an open question whether cognition, including perception, is accompanied by felt experience in a particular case. Now, Thomas Nagel and others have made popular a very broad sense of the term conscious, where consciousness exists if it's just feeling of some kind, if there's something it feels like to be you. And I'm going to accept that way of setting things up, at least for now. I'll also come back later to the question of felt experience in animals without this kind of conspicuous behavioural complexity. But first we'll look at the three obvious groups, where there's decent evidence now, not decisive, but decent, for felt experience in some animals within each of those three groups. In much of this talk, I'm going to go through this evidence, going through a sequence of experiments bearing on various kinds of experience in various kinds of animals, and along the way there'll be messages on philosophical matters. Okay, let's start with pain. Pain, for obvious reasons, is the most well-studied form of felt experience. Aside from vertebrates like ourselves, there's now decent evidence for pain in cephalopods, like the octopus, and some arthropods, in crustaceans and insects. Now, I want to present some of this evidence, just a couple of pieces of it, with a particular emphasis. And I'll start with some phenomena seen in hermit crabs, the crabs that live inside scavenged snail shells. And these phenomena have been studied in some now well-known experiments by Robert Elwood and his collaborators. The aim was to look, in some of this work, at what are called motivational trade-offs in hermit crabs. The idea is something bad happens and you respond with some sort of avoidance or some other measures. If we then ask, well, is it just a reflex or is it something more sophisticated? We look for trade-offs. Does the animal balance the apparent badness of the thing, of this stimulus or this event, with other cost-benefit considerations? Now, in this case, the crabs, when they're slightly shocked with an electric current through a wire that's put deep inside the shell, they will leave the shell. But they'll leave the shell in a way conditioned by the quality of the shell and whether there's the odour of a predator around, which would also make the shell more valuable. So a crab will put up with more shock in circumstances where a shell is more valuable. There's a trade-off between avoiding shock and avoiding other kinds of risks and harms. Now, some doubts have been raised about the details of these experiments. And in many experiments discussed in this talk, there are questions about details. I can talk about them if people are curious. I do want to present the empirical side fairly, but there is also a kind of in-principle role that experiments of this kind can have. We can say, if the scientific side shows such and such, what would that imply or suggest? Okay, suppose someone says trade-offs of this kind are evidence for felt pain-like states. A person might reply, well, not really. I can imagine all this going on with some information processing that's not accompanied by experience at all. Yes, we certainly can. And also, as Kate Lynch and Thomas White note in a talk that's not yet published, trade-off data of this kind is certainly not enough to show something like pain, because slime molds can do it. Slime molds don't have a nervous system at all. Now, you might say this shows that slime molds have pain, but that it's an extreme way to respond to the phenomenon. There's also a paper by Patrick Butlin that fills out the kind of critical response of this kind. Butlin says, basic trade-off phenomena of this sort are not enough to show something like pain because there's a mechanism sufficient for producing them that is very simple, what he refers to as a Pavlovian control mechanism. All that's required is that the system can weigh the strength of two or more competing action tendencies, each of which is a consequence of some directly perceptible feature of the environment. I agree with that criticism as well. But here is some more detail about the crabs. This is a quote from a paper. Shocked hermit crabs show two curious responses apart from just evacuating shells or, and I'll talk about this, grooming their abdomen. For example, a number of crabs that evacuated the shell then felt deep inside in a way that's consistent with them searching for the source of the noxious stimulus. So they do this as well. They leave the shell in this complicated behaviorally sophisticated way. They inspect in some cases and they groom their abdomen. How do those observations fit in? So let's look again at the kind of to and fro that might happen here. Someone says trade-off behavior is evidence for pain. Another person says, well, I can imagine that happening with no feeling. Okay, imagine how. What are you imagining? Let's think about some rival models or family of models of what's going on inside the crabs, and we can distinguish three. There's a kind of reflex-based model. The whole thing is just a collection of reflexes. There's something I'll call model F. There's a state or an event that's felt by the animal as positive or negative, and that has effects that reflect this in its behavior. And there's what I'll call model N. There's a state that's not felt, but is also quite sophisticated. It's integrated with other kinds of information processing and has effects as a consequence. Now, sometimes people have said, once you show some complexity, not just a collection of reflexes, you've done what you need to do to show that something like pain is present. That's not a good argument. And I think there are some passages in my book, Other Minds, that are probably a bit too close to this. In the hermit crab case and others, we know it's not model R. The contrast is between the other two. Okay then, what do we expect to see as well on each of these two options? In particular, if nothing is being felt, what would we expect to see? Now that's a difficult question to ask for several reasons. Firstly, we should accept that different brain architectures might be involved across animals distant from us. So we should not say, well, these animals behave as if they have a pain-like thing going on, but they lack the structures in the brain that underlie feeling in us, so they couldn't feel anything. That would not be a good argument. These animals, for example, can plainly see without having a visual cortex, as we do. So there's at least this much multiple realizability of psychological states. The situation is also difficult because of the peculiarities of the first person point of view here. Felt experience is something we know from our own case, and we can always imagine it absent when considering some organism or some brain structure, even other people, even ourselves at other times. The ease of imagining the presence or absence of experience leads to unrealistic standards being applied in this area. This has been emphasized by Thomas Nagel. Now, in this talk, I'm not going to discuss attitudes where someone says, whatever is going on inside, biologically, it might be happening in an unfelt way. And that's the possibility we have to rule out. A zombie-like scenario in the sense of David Chalmers. Now, I think intuitions and arguments of that kind are worth discussing, but they're not for today. I'm not going to be discussing why anything feels like anything at all. Those questions involve other moves and considerations beside the ones I'll be talking about here. Rather, I want to find some ways of contrasting fallibly the sort of thing we'd expect with a felt state and what we'd expect with an unfelt one. I accept that evolution might build a system that does various survival-enhancing things without building in feeling as part of the process. But that unfelt state that we might posit in response to some finding, what other features does it have? Excuse me. Does it completely shadow the kinds of effects that a felt state would have? If it does, why does it do this? In a computer, we might cook such a thing up, but why would evolution do it? In the motivational trade-off case, for example, a person might say, well, there's a variable in there, in the animal, the registered threateningness of a stimulus. It's registered but not felt. It's the value of a variable in some computational system. The electric shock is not an ecologically normal threat, but it might be similar enough to one. So there's an internal variable inside the animal that has a value, x equals 5, 5 negative units or something like that. And that gets integrated with other variables that represent shell quality, other risks, and so on. It's information processing matter that can be entirely unfelt. Okay, but then we should consider the other kinds of behavior we're seeing. If we go back to that passage from Elwood, the inner state that has those effects on shell leaving also has other effects that do make sense if the whole business is being felt. Why would we expect those if the state had a different role? Why inspect, for example? This is an ecologically unusual situation. The crab has been inside its shell for a long time with no problem. Suddenly there's this stimulus, it leaves, and then it, in some cases, goes back to inspect. We imagine it asking, what the hell happened? What is behind this? Well, shell inspection itself is not unusual in hermit crabs. They do it when they encounter new shells. They inspect the interior and the exterior. I asked Elwood about this. Is the inspection seen here different from the usual kind? This was his reply. He said, what we saw in four crabs was that they spent some time investigating deep in the shell. The head was within the aperture. This is deeper than a normal shell investigation to judge size, not seen except in this experiment involving shock. The behavior is thus different from normal. Well, perhaps this just reflects curiosity, and curiosity might be seen as suggestive of a rich internal economy, but this might still be unfelt information processing. On the other hand, curiosity is linked to attention, which has often been, in empirical and theoretical work, taken to be linked to consciousness in humans, and I'll come back to that later in the talk. But we also have another behavior in response to shock, and that's grooming of the abdomen of the shocked part of the crab. This was initially seen just in one crab in the experiments, but later, when they got the whole thing, the system working better, it was seen much more often. Why is any of this felt, someone says? I could program a computer to do this. Yes, you might. Again, though, why would evolution do it? If we start out from a picture in which nothing that's going on here is being felt by the animal, would we expect this complex of events, this network of behaviors stemming from the stimulus? Grooming, I think, is perhaps especially significant because it doesn't have that apparent cognitive role that inspection might have. Grooming of injured areas is quite common in crustaceans. Shrimp will rub injured antenna on the inside of the tank, for example. Why are they doing that? It's not like licking wounds in mammals where you might be cleaning it. I wonder myself if this phenomenon, it's the phenomenon where an injured area feels better if you are controlling the stimulus to some extent, something familiar from human life. Now, that emphasis on control is a theme that will come back later. If not this, then what? Okay, moving on. Next, we'll talk about an octopus study that complements some of this. Octopuses certainly look like they feel pain. I had this image, this pair of images in my book, Other Minds. What happens is this octopus is raising its rear end high over its head as part of a threatening display while intimidating other octopuses, and a fish came in and bit it right on the tip of its rear end. And in response, the octopus did exactly what you would do if you were raising your rear end over your head and a fish had come in and bit it. There was this great sort of flurry of arms, and then it settled down and went back to beating up other octopuses. Now, I've seen lots of things like this, but of course you might wonder, is this just a reflex or similar? What is going on? Well, the best paper on octopus pain was published by Robin Crook, who's a Bay Area local, UCSF. The background here is that protection and grooming of wounded areas was studied in some octopuses in an older paper. And what Crook wanted to do was look at several behaviours together with some physiology as well. Okay, I'll go quickly through this, even though some of it is not simple. Experiment one, determine which of two visual environments the individual octopus prefers. Give the animal a harmless saline injection. Put it in the normally non-preferred chamber. Take it out. Then give the animal either an injection of vinegar, acetic acid, which is thought to be somewhat painful but not dangerous for an octopus, or saline, either a second saline or the vinegar, and put it in the initially preferred chamber. Take it out and then see which chamber they prefer after this. The ones who'd had the acetic acid injection tended to go to the initially non-preferred chamber, the one that was not associated with the injection. Second experiment. Again, get the initial preference between two visually different chambers for the octopus. Give half the animals an acetic acid injection and half the animals the harmless saline injection. Put them in the initially preferred chamber. Take them out. Then give all the animals lidocaine, which is an anesthetic drug that does work, it seems, on octopuses and various other animals. Then put them in the initially non-preferred chamber. Take them out and see which chamber they prefer after this. Again, the ones who'd been injected with the acetic acid, for whom the lidocaine apparently, you know, did something beneficial, tend to go to the initially non-preferred chamber. Now, I'm going through the paper, this experiment for completeness. This one I'm going to complement with a more sophisticated experiment in another animal in a moment. So if you found this one overly simple or hard to follow, doesn't matter that much. The first one I'll put more emphasis on. There's also another behaviour. The acetic acid injection produced wound tending. The animals groomed the injection site, well, with their beak, which is harder for me to demonstrate. This wasn't seen in the saline injected ones, or only very briefly, and the lidocaine drug eliminated the wound tending. Okay, how does this relate to... Actually, I'll put the report there. How does this relate to the comparison of the felt and unfelt models? So, you know, model N, the no-feeling model. There's something that gets registered. An initial computational... An internal computational variable takes a value. And that's used to direct behaviour in the choice experiments with respect to environments. Fine, okay. That makes some sense of the choice of area. Experiment one makes ecological sense. What about the fact that the drug changes this? Well, you might say the drug changes this unfelt registration of an event by the animal. What about the tending and the grooming, which the drug also The choice is affected if they've had the drug that eliminates the putative pain. What about the tending and the grooming, which is also eliminated by the drug? Why groom? Well, there is a story there. I don't think any of this is decisive, and there's a story to tell here. The grooming seen in these octopuses led to the removal of a small patch of skin by the beak, and Crook says that the acetic acid injection might mimic an anemone or jellyfish sting, and this might be a way of trying to remove the venom. And you might say something like that about some of the crustacean grooming observations also. There's further twists and turns that relate to this one, but I want to go on. Now, the next step I just want to discuss in a very simple and quick way. You might have wondered about the drug experiment and thought, well, someone should do a more sophisticated experiment to see if lidocaine changes the grooming of an injured area behavior in octopuses. I don't know of an octopus one, but there is a new paper discussing this phenomenon just on its own in cuttlefish. I'm not going to go through it in which are octopus relatives. I'm not going to go through this one at all in detail, but the basic finding is that there was lots of grooming of an injured spot in response to an acetic acid injection, and it was greatly reduced by at least high doses of the lidocaine. Okay, I'm going to move on from pain. I don't want to spend the whole talk talking about pain. Part of my general picture could be summarized with the idea that felt experience, putting it simply, is part of the animal way of being. It will be common as an accompaniment to effective agency, which is central to animal life. Now, there are many challenges to a picture like that. For example, blind sight is a phenomena where people with brain lesions can sometimes discriminate and navigate while professing no visual experience or none of the relevant region. And there are some other kinds of sophisticated, apparently unconscious processing in humans. And that is a challenge to the sort of simple picture that I began with. Stan Dehane, who is a pioneer in some of this work, at one point in his book, Consciousness and the Brain, says, okay, if that's all stuff that humans can do unconsciously, what are some things that humans never seem to be able to do unconsciously? And he answers, well, voluntary engagement with novel tasks and objects, especially when there's a temporal sequencing of behaviours. No one's ever found humans doing that kind of thing unconsciously. So motivated, attentive, using the word attentive in a non-question begging way, interaction with objects. Well, octopuses are often interested in novel objects. We see this in particular at a site in Australia, Octopolis, a site we've watched for quite a few years now. We study the octopuses there with GoPro cameras, which are left on tripods. So this is footage taken when no people are around. This is just what the octopuses get up to themselves. And one of the things that we've fairly consistently found is a strong interest in the cameras on the part of the octopuses. They inspect them. Now, as I'll emphasize a couple of times, you know, when an octopus inspects something, you often think it's investigating whether this might be a possible source of food, and I think this certainly applies in this case. But the octopuses remain interested in unusual objects long after I think it's become clear to them, they sometimes move the camera to get a better angle, long after it's become clear to them that this thing is not going to be a source of food. Now, this site, Octopolis, has been quiet, unfortunately, for quite a while now. There were almost no octopuses there when I last visited in February of this year. All the videos that I'll show a few more videos, are from a kind of golden age at Octopolis, which was around 2014 to 2016. Okay, as I emphasized a moment ago, this is another one of the sort of rear-end overhead displays. It's not quite clear why this one's doing it. They do take an interest in the cameras, and this interest extends in some cases to bringing them home. I'll show one more video of the same sort. This one's actually from our second site, which is called Octlantis rather than Octopolis, but it has a similar kind of combination of behaviours. These cameras, as you can see, they have divers' weights on the legs. They're quite heavy. It'd be quite an awkward thing for an octopus to bring home. Okay, so here we're seeing engagement, attentive and motivated exploration of a novel object. Not what people usually have in mind as a candidate for unconscious behaviour. Okay, next I'm going to talk about dreams. Keep an eye on the time. Okay. Dreaming is such an elusive aspect of experience. It's hard enough to study even in us with the difficult relations between experience, recall, and report. Especially given this difficulty, we have better evidence of non-human animal dreams than I think we really had any right to expect. And this is due to various quirks of individual animals, including octopuses, rats, and birds. Now, in the octopus case, there's a well-known video from a documentary, a PBS documentary, with David Scheel called The Octopus in My House, where Heidi, the octopus, appears to go through a series of dream experiences. I'm not going to play the video, but you may be interested in having a look at that sometime afterwards. The octopus goes through a sequence of colour and pattern changes while it's asleep. Now, that has a sort of dreamlike look about it, but how can we get past mere impressions? So let's look in more detail at the possibility of dreams in these animals. Sleep in humans has several phases, especially there's a distinction between REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, versus non-REM sleep, a quieter kind of sleep. Dreaming is seen especially in REM sleep, though not only in REM sleep, and that's studied in part by awakening experiments, where you wake up someone at a particular stage in sleep and ask them if they were dreaming. Now, sleep itself is all over the animal kingdom, not just in bilaterian animals like the octopuses and so on. It's also been seen in some form in jellyfish. And an active-quiet distinction within sleep is also very common. It's seen in arthropods, in bees and flies, it's seen in octopuses, it's seen in vertebrates like us. I'm not sure about various others, but it's in those, it's the active quiet sleep distinctions in all three of those groups. Bees have three phases of sleep, just to sort of one up the others. In some, so that's a fly paper. In some spiders, there's a literal rapid eye movement situation. Now, lots of animals don't have movable eyes, but some spiders do, jumping spiders. And in the newly emerged, the brand new little spiderlings, the movements of the eyes can be directly observed through the temporarily translucent exoskeleton. You can see inside what the eyes are getting up to. And you can watch them while they are asleep. And it's been determined that there's something like a distinction between quiet sleep and a REM sleep stage in these spiders, with rapid eye movements and some twitching of the legs as well. Now, I think this is surprising to say the least, even before we start to think about dreaming. The idea that there is this distinction between active and quiet sleep across such distant animals, it probably evolved several times independently. If you think about the last common ancestor of bilaterian animals, probably didn't have eyes, very limited behaviour. Very much doubt it had anything like this going on. So that is very interesting. But why might we think there are dreams, experienced events in these distant animals? Well, let's do the octopus case in detail. Cephalopods are special in general because the skin is a window in. The chromatophores, the colour-changing machinery in the skin, is controlled by the brain, and can be active during sleep, as in Heidi the octopus. So they can go through patterns and colour changes suggestive of different internal states and modes of action. So this might be a case of what in humans and other animals is referred to as dream enacting behaviour. Let's go through some details here. Again, there is active sleep in octopuses with an alternation between this and the quieter state. There are short periods of active sleep, around a minute, with dynamic patterns and colour changes. And the quiet state, so far in this paper, is just being marked out behaviourally. There's also been one interesting anecdotal report of an octopus having nightmares. This was in one animal in a lab. This paper's not yet been published. I'm not going to put too much weight on that. And in the newest study, a much more invasive and somewhat creepy study, there was a tracking of oscillatory brain activity, brain rhythms, during active sleep, looking for an association between a brain signature of active sleep and skin colours and skin colour changes and patterns. So in REM sleep in us and other active sleep animals, the active mode has different brain patterns, more active and less synchronised, more akin to the waking brain. In octopuses, they found that active sleep has the same association between skin patterns and waking-like brain activity. Still, how do we show the link between this window and experience? This is a window into something in the animal. Why is it a window suggestive of experience? Well, let's go back to the human case and press on that a little more. And here I'm going to sort of put together pieces of the puzzle in a way that's been helped a lot by some correspondence with David Scheel, the same octopus guy who lived with Heidi. In humans, there is dream enacting behaviour, which is pathological. It's a breakdown of sleep paralysis during REM sleep. So RBD stands for REM sleep behaviour disorder. This is not sleepwalking, which happens during non-REM sleep, apparently, and appears not to be associated with dreaming. It's a REM sleep enacting of behaviour with a sort of failure of the paralysis that would normally prevent dreams, well, what we think of as dream states being enacted. In the octopus case, this is not pathological or special because there doesn't seem to be a need to shut down the skin patterning changes during sleep. If the octopus nightmare observation is real, that would be different. I mean, that would mess things up if the animal did all that stuff in the wild, but changing your colours probably doesn't make a big difference to your risk level if you're an octopus and you're asleep in your den. Now, in the human case, what is the link between dream enacting behaviour and experienced dreams? Suppose someone was sceptical about that link. One thing we'd really like is a waking experiment, like the REM, non-REM sleep experiment that I mentioned earlier, where you're trying to work out how common dreams are in the different kinds of sleep. So you wake people up and you ask if they were dreaming during a particular kind of sleep. There's never been a study of that kind so far as I know. Dream enacting behaviour in humans is a bit rare and special. Some people do wake up spontaneously and can report what they were dreaming before, you know, while they were enacting some behaviour in bed. And there are papers on those reports with an association between reported content and observed behaviour, but the studies are based on interviews and questionnaires, after-the-fact stuff. A lot of this, interestingly, is about dreams people have in pregnancy and soon after giving birth. There is, though, a French study on the association between direction of gaze during rapid eye movement sleep and the dream enacting behaviours that would be visually guided if the person was awake. So the question is, to what extent do eye movements, which you can track to some extent while a person is asleep with their eyes closed, to what extent does eye gaze relate to dream enacting behaviour that's been observed? Now, the paper describes plenty of puzzles, but a decent association between the two. No attempt to wake people up during dream enacting behaviour and ask them what's going on, but a few people did wake up spontaneously. One person was being chased by lions, and he escaped by leaping out of the bed and woke up as he placed his hand on the floor. Okay, we can add to that piece of the puzzle another paper using eye tracking, which found that there was a match between dream content and eye movement. This was a study of lucid dreaming, where you know that you're dreaming, and voluntary tracking of a target during a lucid dream. So it's pretty far in some ways from what we want, it being a lucid dream. Though, one subject in this study had a non-lucid dream in which he dreamt that he was practicing the eye tracking task that he'd be doing during the lucid dream. And his eyes behaved the right way during his non-lucid dream of the lucid dream task. Okay, let's put all that together. In humans, there's a link between dream enacting behavior, you know, running in bed, fighting and things like that, and what's reported to be dreamed after the fact. There's also a link between dream enacting behavior and eye movements, with a scrap of fortuitous data on dream content that was not merely reported later. So the guy who's being chased by lions. There's also a link between dream content and eye movements in lucid dreams, which are very special, of course. And again, a tiny scrap of data on dream content and eye movement in a non-lucid dream, but reported after the fact. Okay, they're pieces of a puzzle. None of this is supposed to be decisive. But if we believe this is decent evidence that dream enacting behavior is often accompanied by matching dream content in humans, how good is this as evidence that dream enacting behavior of the color changing kind is accompanied by matching dream content in octopuses? Where here all we have is the dream enacting behavior, we don't have the report, we don't have the eye tracking. Well, you might not buy the dream enacting behavior to experience link even in us. But why buy it in us and not others? Well, in response to that, why are dreams experienced in us? I take it we don't know the, you know, why are dreams experienced at all in us? We don't know the answer to that. It might be that there's so much of normal waking brain activity that's engaged during certain stages in REM sleep that you do just get experience because of the activation of those parts of the brain. If that's the story about us, then the argument might carry over fallibly to octopuses. You know, if all that normal waking brain activity is, sorry, if normal waking brain activity is conscious in their case, and here we look at the pain work, we look at the videos and so on, the other octopus work, if we then map the relationship between dream experience and the kind of special form of brain activity seen in human dreams, if we map that relationship over to the octopuses, it would seem at least suggested, perhaps likely, that because so much of normal waking brain activity is being generated in octopuses during REM sleep, well, during active sleep, as reflected in their colour changes, but there's probably experience in there as well. Okay, I'm trying to cover lots of things, so yeah, okay, that's good. I'll leave dreams. Another behaviour. There was a study of social learning in bumblebees in Lars Chitka's lab in the UK. The point was to see if bees could acquire a very unnatural skill, rolling balls backwards into a hole to get a reward, essentially playing basketball, and whether they could learn to do this by observing others. And they could do this. Some bees learned to do it, and they could learn by observing others, and they could improve on the way they had been taught it. Then it was noticed that you don't have to reward the bees to get them to do some of this rolling. They would do it anyway. and that was the basis of a new paper. Now, in the first paper, there was an emphasis on how unnatural ball rolling is for a bee. I've had some correspondence with people questioning this, but that was an emphasis in the first paper. So we have an unnatural behaviour that's learnable. And now, in the second paper, it seems it is intrinsically rewarding. It appears to be a form of play or something akin to play. So in the second paper, the paper about the play, the question asked was, will bees go out of their way to do this? Yes, they will. They'll spend time rolling balls, which they could be spending on a food source. And also, there was a chamber colour associated with balls that could be rolled rather than being fixed for the bees. And bees preferred, to some extent, this was a bit sketchy, the colour of a chamber that had been experienced by them as the ballroom, the room where the balls could be rolled. There's some photos of bees rolling the balls. Okay, I'm going to bring up one more paper before I talk about interpretation. This is a much newer paper about flies, fruit flies. Play-like behaviour exhibited by the fruit fly Drosophila melanogaster, another UK study. What they did was they enriched some flies' environments with a spinning platform to see how they would interact with it, essentially giving them a carousel or a merry-go-round if they wanted to ride it. And they found that some flies like it and some do not. There was a distinction between seeker and avoider flies, where most flies, about two-thirds, do not like the carousel. But a bit less than a third of the flies do seek it and spend prolonged periods of time on it. Some of the flies liked, in particular, to switch between opposite moving carousels. There were clockwise and anti-clockwise carousels, and they would spend time on one and then spend some time on the other. And time spent on the carousel was at the expense of time spent on a food patch. Okay, how do we interpret this pair of experiments? Well, in the bee case, something that might be relevant is the idea that sheer efficacy can be rewarding no matter what is being achieved. The idea of the joy at being the cause was explored by Karl Grus in the late 19th century. He was a philosopher and psychologist writing about play in animals and humans. David Graeber, in his wonderful book Bullshit Jobs, recently made much of the idea of the joy at being the cause. Alison Gopnik here at Berkeley and her collaborators have some very rich new work in press now, linking the idea that empowerment is rewarding to causal learning and exploration by babies. So as Gopnik sees it, intervention is the key to effective learning, manipulating things, intervening on things. So if you, as either God or evolution, want to build a good learner, the first thing you might do is build a creature that finds efficacy rewarding, no matter what's being achieved. Now, this might apply to the bees, the bumblebees. They're getting something done in a novel way, and that might be rewarding. Is that compatible with a kind of Model N unfelt picture of a situation? Maybe it is. I'll come back to that in a moment. In the fly case, though, there's no question of efficacy. It's a completely passive matter once you've hopped onto the carousel. Now, the authors of the fly paper do tell a story about how this might be good for the fly because it's training its body self, its sense of itself, its sense of the relationship between self-caused and other-caused sensory events, due to the sort of unusual mixture of effects that doing something and doing nothing has in that case. Maybe, and I'm not sure to what extent, adding a kind of self-improvement story here might bear on the question of whether this is being experienced. Something I find myself puzzling thinking about all these play-type phenomena is there's a temptation to think that when an animal seeks out very unusual, non-ecologically normal, rewarding states, this is special evidence for subjective experience. Now, why is that? One thing it does do is show complexity. It shows that they're not really merely sort of following simple fixed action patterns. Perhaps it's because what's being shown is that very novel states, or especially in the fly case, very novel combinations of stimuli. It's not one thing. It's the unusual combination of appearance of motion without doing any flying yourself. When you show that some unusual combination of features of stimuli like that can be rewarding for the animal, maybe that's showing something about the role of valence within its internal economy. But I feel there's a step missing there. There's something I'm not quite seeing, or something that might be studied to shed more light on this. All right, that's all the experiments. And now for the last section of this talk, for a few minutes, I'm going to talk about what this might mean. So there's evidence now, I think, decent evidence, not decisive, none of it's decisive, for felt experience in animals within each of the three groups I distinguished at the start: arthropods, cephalopods, and our group. How many origins was there in history for consciousness of this at least minimal kind? You know, how many times did it evolve? You know, a natural thought is you might say, well, three times looks like a natural answer to that question. Certainly, if the common ancestor lacked it, if it was a lights-out organism, then we're looking at more than one. But we can see the pressure that's going to come if we push too hard on these counting operations. We were imagining the lights off in the last common ancestor of bilaterally symmetrical animals, and then the lights come on several times, perhaps three times. Probably a bad model, an on-off model. Maybe there's a dimmer switch. It's that kind of light, but still natural to ask, within a dimmer switch model, was the last common ancestor a little bit of a yes or a complete no? Well, with a trait like this, it's natural to expect gradual change, not just in the sense that, you know, once you have it, you can get more sophistication, but it's natural, I think, to expect no sharp divide between the yes and the no. I think we should expect grey area cases that are neither yes nor no. Quite a few philosophers are committed to the impossibility of this. They say it doesn't make any sense, and we can rule it out for that reason. You're conscious if there's something it's like to be you. And a natural thing to say is that, well, something versus nothing, that's a sharp distinction, if anything is. I think this, however, is a problem on our side, a problem with our concepts, a problem with our imagination, and a strongly gradualist scenario is likely to be true. For evolutionary reasons, it's likely looking down the tree into the past. There probably was not historically a lights-on moment. And once that is available, it's natural to apply it looking across the tree as well, to animals other than those conspicuous ones, the bumblebees and the octopuses that I've emphasized here. So earthworms, gastropods, slugs and snails, and so on, neurally simpler than the animals I've been discussing here, they sometimes have hints of the features I've been discussing, and a kind of graded presence of felt experience or consciousness in those cases seems a natural, well, to me it seems a likely way that things will turn out. Well, how will these neither yes nor no cases end up being described? Well, we can't say. The vocabulary is not yet available. But I can say something about a possible future form for views of this kind, based on the analogy, or, well, the just based on a comparison between the case of experience or consciousness and life itself, being alive. It is, and certainly was, possible to worry about the coherence of grey area cases with respect to life, and viruses are an easy example. I think that as the phenomena of life came to be better understood during the 20th century, Any anxiety of that kind, you know, can we make sense of a halfway case? Shouldn't this be a yes or no matter? Any anxiety of that kind dissipated because there was a benign fragmentation of the concept of life into a family of metabolic activities concerned with self-maintaining chemical processes and a set of reproduction-related capacities which relate to evolution. Now, the metabolic side and the reproduction-related side are tied together a lot of the time, but they can come apart in special cases, as with viruses. Now, when there's a fragmentation of a concept, a hard concept like life, it's not inevitable that grey area cases will come to look harmless. We might end up with a finer-grained vocabulary that still makes vagueness look problematic. But in the actual case of life, the finer-grained account makes grey area cases look harmless. And I think if this is a partial model for the case of the felt side of the mind, even if we don't have a very clear view of what the kind of descendant vocabularies might look like. Okay, one final point. There's another question prompted by this look at grey area cases and the diversity of animals across the tree. Are we wrong to suppose that there's a single phenomenon here at all, that felt experience or consciousness is, across all these varieties, a thing that will get a biological explanation of its own? Might it instead be a situation where there's a range of quite different traits without a core in common? There's a paper by Jeffrey Lee, a philosopher here at Berkeley, where he asks us to challenge this assumption and raises the possibility of what he calls a deflationary pluralism about consciousness. And it would change the way we try to make sense of, well, change the way we try to make biological sense of these various things we've been calling forms of consciousness across different animals. We might not treat this as a unified thing at all, not treat it as a unified thing with varieties, treat it as something that doesn't really have a core in that sense. This possibility was also emphasized by Dan Dennett in some of the last talks that I saw him give before his death. Dennett thought that some of the appearance of mystery about consciousness comes from an ideologically constructed unity in how we think about the phenomenon. Yes, right, that is a possibility in principle. It's one to take seriously. But in a way that I had not expected, the picture that's been emerging from the most recent work that I've been discussing in this talk, I think pushes in the other direction. It pushes in the opposite direction. The impression it gives is one of surprising unity across different animals with respect to what sort of thing experience looks like. There are some surprising similarities in where they've ended up. The pain work, the dream work, also the play work, I find all that work pushes this way. Now, this is true. I think there's something to note here. Even if we forget about consciousness, experience, and just think about the mind more generally or the cognitive side. But, you know, there is this surprising set of similarities. But on the topic of experience, pain, dreams, and the intrinsic reward of play, those are all facets of experience in us. Pain, dreams, the intrinsic reward of play. There's a hole there, and those facets in us give some sense of the shape of the whole. And in these other animals, we also see facets, the same or similar sorts of facets, to a degree that's unexpected. It makes the wholes, I think, look potentially more similar across cases. We can imagine, or at least try to imagine, a situation where there's massive divergence across where different animals have ended up psychologically, where there are few or none of these familiar resonances. Now, it is reasonable to wonder, if that's how things were, how we might find this if that was a situation. How could we recognise a situation where the The thing we're sort of crudely calling experience in different animals is profoundly alien and divergent across cases. It's also true that we tend to look for certain features when we, you know, features that we know in ourselves when we study and wonder about others. So our search is definitely biased. It is a biased search in that way, but that doesn't mean we were bound to find what we found, the dreams and the play and the rather comprehensible looking pain phenomena. Now, I don't know myself what would be more philosophically amazing, to look across and see such diversity that we can't interpret it at all, or look across and see this similarity, these glimmers of similarity across all the different lifestyles. Comparing our situation now with how things looked when I started thinking about these things, you know, thinking about what seemed reasonable to anticipate, there seemed to be a lot more signs of unity now than I would have expected back then. Okay, I'm going to finish just quickly with some thanks. It really is a great pleasure to be here. I want to emphasize that. This is a university I've long held up as a model. I have irritated many people in Australia by continually presenting the UC system as a model for how a serious public university system should work. The UC system and the whole structure of the Californian public university system. I was very glad to study myself at UCSD. I'd like to thank also some collaborators and discussants who've helped me with these things, David Scheel in this case especially. And lastly, I would like to thank the Wreck Bay Aboriginal community who manage Booterie National Park, where Octopolis and Octlantis are found.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.